The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, the pod where we predict the Euros so you don't have to. A handy group-by-group guide from the group of death to the group of I didn't even know these teams had qualified. Who's good, who isn't? Who you thought was good because they were good in the 90s? Who are the dark horses? Who are just the horses? Also, the Guardian have done player profiles for the 622 players in the tournament. We'll find out just how time-consuming that was and learn about which Portugal player is Coldplay's biggest fan. By the end of the pod, you'll know who's going to win the tournament so you don't have to watch any of it. All that and your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, John Bruin, welcome.
Hello, Max.
Hello, John. Hello, Lars Sivertsen.
Good morning, Max.
Good morning, Lars. Good morning, Nikki Bandini.
Good morning, Max. How are you?
Hello. I'm really, really good. Thanks very much. And it says here in front of me, before we start, you may have spotted our artwork has changed for the duration of the Euros. This is the tiny square that appears on your podcast app or wherever you download your podcasts. It says, don't be alarmed. If that is the sort of thing that alarms you, you are presumably very easily alarmed. But if it has alarmed you, don't worry. It was all part of the planning. It'll go back to the yellow when the football season starts. But for the Euros, we are Football Weekly every day.
Listen, Max, yes. It's been a long 18 months. We've all spent a lot of time inside. Yeah. Maybe we're very sensitive to these things.
Possible.
Now. You shouldn't be down, you know.
No, you're right. I shouldn't mock. If changing something from yellow to blue alarms you, this is not like Cardiff City changing their shirt from blue to red. I think that's what's important to say. You know, it's still very much the DNA of the Guardian Football Weekly. Right, let's go through each group of the Euros, work out who's going to finish where, and then predict who's going to win the whole thing. And let's begin with Group F, the group of death. France, Germany, Portugal and Hungary, just because that, John, is a brilliant European Championship group. Something that annoys me is that third place actually might qualify, because part of the joy is that some huge footballing nation would go out, but they all could go through. But even still, it's a brilliant group, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And in the expanded tournaments, you fear that groups of death will no longer be so deadly. And I suppose that third place does remove an element of jeopardy. But yeah, come on, you can't really get beyond the world champions, the defending champions and permanent champions, Germany. So, yeah, here we go. And at this point, you have to say France look the best equipped to do it. Though the calling up Benzema, you know, this is the thing that everyone said, right, they're going to be even better because they called up Benzema. But it was put to me the other day by someone who certainly knows better than I do, that calling up Benzema was desperation. Because it suggested that Didier Deschamps didn't have a striker. Now, that's actually a common problem with quite a lot of the teams as we'll go through the 24. But also, you know, let us remember the circumstances of Benzema's previous expulsion, some of which are highly legal and involve naughty videos and stuff like that. What I'm saying is, if Deschamps panicking, then everyone should be panicking, really.
You've got panic about the changing of a small square on your podcast, and now you panic about the whole Euro.
As you say, John, the case against Karim Benzema is an active one. It's important to say that Benzema has denied any wrongdoing.
Could lay claim to being the best pure centre-forward in Europe still, even at his advanced age. France look absolutely outstanding. Portugal, again, it was put to me by someone who knew a bit more than me that Ronaldo's a problem because he's Ronaldo and he has to play. And then Germany, if you follow the logic of Jonathan Wilson, Yogi Love, World Cup winner, is the problem. And Jonathan's been banging that drum for quite a long time. I watched Germany's team win the under-21s on Sunday. And that is a country overflowing with footballing talent. And yet he's had to do a Deschamps and bring back the old guys, hasn't he, in Thomas Muller and Mats Hummels.
So again,
they're panicking too.
Lars?
Right, so on France, yes, I'd say the best team on paper, and if you had to pick a winner, then you'd go in that direction. If we're trying to pick holes in it, if we're trying to see what might go wrong for this magnificent squad, you do wonder if bringing in Griezmann is actually sort of gilding the lily a little bit here. And I saw against Wales in the friendly, they deployed a sort of diamond midfield, which I wonder, because, okay, listen, if you look at the names, it looks terrifying. They started with Pogba and Rabiot as the sort of wide shuttling midfielders. Tolisso started at the base of midfield, but you imagine that'll be N'Golo Kante. And then a sort of attacking trident of Griezmann and Mbappe and Benzema. It is slightly terrifying. But I would worry a little bit if they play like that. I mean, where's the width coming from? Neither Pavard or Hernandez are like massively rampaging attacking fullbacks. It might end up being a bit narrow and a bit stodgy. But then we remember France, when they won the World Cup in Russia, didn't always play well. Didn't always play exciting football. It was more about the fact that they... I nearly swore there. They messed up the least defensively. I mean, that's really why they won. They were in a team with a lot of defensive messing up happening. They messed up the least. And they had Mbappe and a couple of other attacking aces who can just score goals against anyone. And that is probably still the recipe. But I am kind of grasping at straws a little bit as to why the best team on paper shouldn't win the tournament.
I do think, like, this team chemistry thing is not a non-issue. And I don't think it's as simple as, oh, if you're all good mates in the squad, then you're going to have a great Euros. But I do think that when you listen to the stories told by footballers who have won these major competitions, it is always part of the story they tell you. And it's always something that they tell you is important. I have never spoken to a World Cup winner or a Euro winner who hasn't said to me at some point, well, you have to understand, we had this great dynamic between us. We were all in each other's heads. We all understood each other. We all liked each other. And is that going to upset the apple cart a bit for this team? It's not just what happened with Benzema, with the blackmail case that is an ongoing legal case. It's also the fact that he's called Olivier Giroud a go-kart before now and can call himself a go-kart to his Ferrari. It's funny and it's silly, but what if those two genuinely don't like each other? I don't know that. I'm speculating to a great extent. Maybe that is something that they will laugh about with each other. But Giroud's selflessness has been a really important part, actually, of France's recent successes. And if you take him out of it, look, Benzema is an astonishingly good number nine, who somehow, I think, still doesn't get the credit for how good he is as a footballer. And he also can be tremendously unselfish on the pitch. That was the whole reason, I think, that people didn't see how good he was when Ronaldo was there. But I don't think those dynamics are something we should just ignore completely. I think those things do matter, and perhaps even more this year, because the COVID bubble is going to make this more intense. Families aren't going to be able to even come in and out freely. So players are going to be with each other a lot, and they're going to have to deal with each other's company a lot. And if there is anything that disrupts that, I think it's not to completely ignore.
I wonder if... you know, if you talk to people who've won the World Cup, that they look back with rose-tinted spectacles, that they got on because they were winning, rather, you know, if they look for excuses. You talk about players spending a lot of time together. Barney's piece about England includes a great story about how in 2010, Jermaine Defoe and Wayne Rooney were so bored that they ended up watching Wayne Rooney's video on wedding video on DVD, the whole recording of Rooney's wedding. What was Defoe? What am I doing here? Why do I need to see this? Anyway, can we talk about Germany squad then? You mentioned sort of bringing in the old guys. Like, I mean, I saw Mats Hummels pass to Serge Gnabry in this huge win over Latvia and have decided Germany are going to win it now. What do you think, Lars?
So there's a lot of really good players there, but some interesting conundrums for Love, because you have quite a lot of good players in very similar positions. Like, you have Toni Kroos, Kimmich, Gundogan, Goretzka, and I really like Florian Neuhaus as well. So you got four, maybe five brilliant central midfielders. Like, you can't play them all. What do you do? You have good attackers, but none of them are like out and out number nine. So you, like, Thomas Müller is his thing. You know, Gnabry, Havertz, Sané, Werner. this is all very exciting, but there's no obvious sort of focal point. And you have issues in defense. Like, none of the fullbacks are particularly inspiring. The way it looks, I mean, it looks like the team that played against Latvia is more or less the team they're going to go with. And he moved Kimmich to right wing back there, which I think is very wise, because if you have way too many players in midfield and one of them can play wing back and fullback, so at least move him out there. But it is, you know, I find myself using this phrase quite a lot when I was writing previews. There is definitely a Euro winning team there, but you're not fully convinced that Joachim Löw can find it. And what I would also say is it's not immediately obvious what it is either. So it's not like it's easy. But I'm really intrigued to see how he you know, lines up.
Interesting Conundrums for Löw is your Power Ballads album, isn't it, Lars? I look forward to hearing all those tracks. John, Portugal. Most importantly, a large number of the squad are huge Coldplay fans. I know, as a music snob, that will hurt you. I like Coldplay, and I'm proud to say it, and so does my wife. But who from your investigations into Portugal? I mean, that's clearly not the most important part of it, but let's do that first.
I believe the biggest fan of them is Ruben Neves of Wolves. He must have got very excited when he's driving on the team coach past. Thinking of, you know, of the inspiration that Coldplay have given the world through through England and Chris Martin, and what a genius he is. Now, I'm glad you asked me about Portugal, because you look at the talent in that squad, I mean, it still does include José Font and Pepe, which Richard Jolystat, it's the only defensive partnership collectively older than Roy Hodgson. but this is the thing. I mean, you know, we forget, don't we, a lot of the time, because Portugal produces so many talented attacking players that Portuguese coaches tend to be quite conservative in their approach. And Fernando Santos is certainly in that mould. And you would expect them to follow the blueprint with which they won Euro 2016, despite the fact they've probably got a much more talented squad, dripping with quite a few players that we're familiar with from the Premier League. But as I said before, it is about Ronaldo, and as Juventus have found, and I suppose Real Madrid did towards the end of his time there, it is pretty much about building a team that works in spite of him and yet gives him his moments of glory. It's a difficult one, though him and Fernando Santos seem to have a great relationship. Of the team that you suspect that might come third in this group, Portugal could either... It's one of those where I think they could either win the group or they could go in third. They're just... I don't know. I mean, José Font, great player for them. Pepe, great player, but... group for them over the years, but they can be got at, can't they?
I was just, because we were talking before about whether the third team having a good chance of getting through undermines the spectacle in some sense. Well, let's not forget that Portugal finished third in a group that contained Hungary last time out, and Hungary were the team that finished first in that group. So even the sort of idea that none of these teams could slip up and let Hungary get ahead of them, I think is a bit... false. I think Hungary are going to be the weakest team in this group without question, but because it is only three games, you lose one game to Hungary and your whole tournament is at risk. I think that what you said about Ronaldo is exactly right, and I think it was absolutely the story at Juventus. He was Serie A's top scorer. So can he still score goals? Yes. Can he still win games for you? Yes. I think the narrative that was the damaging one for him at Juventus this season, the one that was, I think, the hardest to escape from, is he didn't do it in the important games over and over again this season. But I think there's no question in my mind that he will be as switched on as you get Ronaldo right now. I think he's going to want to, after that difficult season, give everything.
Tactically, the fact that Ronaldo in the latter stage of his years has just morphed into a pure striker, or just someone who likes to lurk around up front waiting for goals and just wants to get in the box and score, that really works for Portugal, because as much as they develop tremendous attacking players, they haven't always developed outstanding number nines. I mean, André Silva has had an amazing year in the Bundesliga, so maybe it'll be a little bit harsh on him that he probably won't start here. But with all the sort of great attacking midfielders and wingers they produce, the fact that he's morphed into this sort of this goal monster it works for them.
Okay, let's do let's work out this group then. John, what are you saying? 1, 2, 3, 4.
Well, I'm going to stick my neck out and say Hungary might come bottom of this group. Okay. But I'm going to go for France top, Portugal second, Germany third.
Anyone want to counter that, or are we happy with that?
The thing is, yes, I agree with that order, but I think that I will not be at all stunned if Hungary do pull off one upset and that's enough to get them through.
All right, let's do Group D. And we've done a lot on England. We'll do a lot on Thursday as well. Charlie saying, at what stage, Max, will you start whacking the shit out of that chair in Wetherspoons? It is not me. A Grealish winner versus the Scots, a quarterfinal penalty shootout against the Portuguese, or is it purely for the final only? I'm more interested from you lot let's do the group as we would do the group. England, Czech Republic, Croatia, Scotland. I think when the draw was done, a lot of England fans thought that's quite a nice group. Lars, is it a nice group, or is it actually deceptively difficult?
I don't think it's a nice group, really, no. I mean, you're facing Scotland, which is, England taking, being in any way complacent going into that game would be incredibly stupid. You're facing the team that knocked you out of the last World Cup. And you're facing a Czech Republic team that I think you'd be foolish to underestimate. I watched them play Belgium last year in the Nations League, I think it was, and they were significantly better than Belgium in that game. Was it last year? It was.
Producer Joel recently, saying Suchek is definitely going to score a header from a set piece against England, isn't it?
I say it wasn't even last year. It was this year in the World Cup qualifiers. Sorry, my brain is sort of melted down for a moment there.
That's okay.
Right, they weren't very good against Italy in the friendly recently, the Czech, but they have a very good performance in them. I wouldn't be too complacent about them either. So this is a tricky group. As has been said, I'm sure already, I'm more worried about what happens to England if they win the group than they face, of course, what the runners-up from the group of death, which I think will be very bad for England. So actually, the fact that it's a tricky group might work in their favour, Jeff.
John, what's your England feeling at the moment?
Well, I feel with England as a nation is following its classic trajectory with a couple more variables added in, but essentially, I don't think I can remember a tournament we didn't go into without the best players being injured or half injured, and confusion over what the coach is going to do. I mean, I've seen people talk about how perhaps Glenn Hoddle was the last one to know what he was doing when he went into a tournament, but if I recall correctly, he didn't pick Michael Owen and David Beckham for the first matches. So it's, there is obviously a lot of optimism, but there's also, unfortunately, this undercurrent at the moment with the fans. I get bad vibes, though I always get bad vibes. But I think over the weekend, Gareth Southgate spoke so well and has repeatedly spoken so well, and has shown that he, as a statesman, is a fine man, but I'm not quite sure about him as a manager, and I think that's fair. That's a fair comment, and I do think that the selection of Ben White, who I think is a good player by the way, reflected again panic within the team, because you said essentially you've got a 26-man squad, and yet you have to bring in a utility player at the last minute because you're concerned about injuries within the squad. That's a concern. So I am not overly optimistic about England. I think you could probably sum up what I've just said there.
Yeah, no, I know we spoke about England a lot. You spoke about England a lot in the last episode. But I was like, you look at the squad and yeah, you get excited because it's like Mount and Sterling and Foden and Grealish and Sancho and Rashford and Saka. You know, all these guys can play at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, you can only pick a couple of those. And then the rest of the squad are a little bit more... well, there are some iffy points to it. So I'm not fully...
I completely disagree with you guys, by the way. Like, I feel like someone needs to be a voice of contrariness here. And I think you guys are... I think you guys are massively underselling England. I think England should... not to be disrespectful to other teams in this group, but I think they should win this group. I think that... I'm not someone who gets particularly high on England, while the English media around me often do.
There you are, singing Vindaloo, Nikki, walking down the street, St George's Crosses, going, wah, it's coming
home.
My
allegiances to the Italian side of my family when it comes to football are well known, but I just think this group is really exciting. I think there's some things that bother you about it. A lot of this was covered really well by the guys yesterday. Harry Maguire's injury is a problem. And there is this question of how you use all these elements. I thought Jonathan spoke to this really well yesterday. I am very much of the school that stop thinking about who is the literal best player and think about what your best 11 is. And that's a conundrum for Southgate. But wouldn't you rather have Harry Kane up front and Jack Grealish running off him, or Mason Mount behind him, or Ben Foden behind him, than most of what lots of other teams have? I mean, within this group.
Phil Foden. Ben Foden does quite a good sportsman. I'm not sure. It'd be an interesting...
If Conundrums for Love is sort of my power ballad album, I think I Get Bad Vibes, the John Bruin story, is a good autobiography in the future.
Can we talk about Scotland briefly? We did yesterday, and Ewan was on last week and will be again soon. Positive vibes coming out of the camp, John. I'm starting to feel the positive vibes. They might have gone too early, Scotland.
Yes, well, they're almost like the opposite of England, aren't they? Because England can arrive with this doomy, bad vibes thing, whereas Scotland are the optimist ahead of a tournament. That's the way. And the thing is, I am old enough to remember Scotland playing in major tournaments, but they do arrive with that optimism and, you know, let's see what we can do. Obviously, with the caveat, if the Delamitri song don't come home too soon, this time they won't have too far to travel when they go home. But they're a very likeable team, despite him being one of the most dour men in Scottish football, which is a very dour man, by the way. I think Steve Clarke is a very likable manager, and away from the media glare, is also a very likable guy too. He's a manager who uses a team which is slightly imbalanced because you've got two good left backs. He uses it well, and I think Scotland are going to be a credit to the tournament. Actually, I really hope so. I really hope they go through. Actually, because one thing is, I'm not old enough to remember Scotland going through the group stage of a tournament. Because I'm not sure they ever have done.
They never have. No one is that old.
No.
Lars, give us a 1-2-3-4 then for Group D.
Oh, good Lord. Listen, the most likely thing is England, Croatia, Czech Republic, Scotland. But I have no great confidence in that order. No, England should win the group. You're right. Croatia should be a stronger team than Czech Republic and Scotland. Complete toss-up between those two, I think. I'd go with Scotland, sure. Having just implored your guys not to sleep on the Czech, I will now doom them to failure by picking Scotland over them.
Okay, fine. Fine. Excellent stuff. That'll do for part one. Part two, Group A and Group B. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly on Thursday night before the Euros. The ultimate Euros preview, not like this ultimate Euros preview we're doing right now, though. One that involves, I'm not going to give much away, but Mark Langdon's halftime efforts are tremendous. You can get tickets from theguardian.com/guardianlive, 7:30 p.m. I'll start tweeting hourly about it soon. But tickets are selling well. Me, Lars, Wilson... Barry, Live, Fitbar, also, and a bit more. Hopefully, hopefully some Baku entertainment as well. But I don't want to give too much away. Right, Group A. Italy, Switzerland, Turkey, Wales. Italy playing the opening game on Friday night against Turkey, Nicky. Lots of people saying they're the dark horses, to the point where they are just horses now, surely.
I haven't checked the odds recently. I think the odds certainly for them were longer than they should have been up till fairly recently. I think they have a really compelling team right now. They're unbeaten in, I think, 27 matches. They won every game in qualifying, which they've never done before. You can undoubtedly look at the teams they've played against and think they haven't played against the top sides in Europe. But it's a good team. I think a bit like England, what makes me feel so positive about it is the depth of it. I think that if you had told me a couple of years ago, hey, you've got to make this midfield and Verratti's going to suffer an injury right before the tournament, I would have thought, that's bad news. That's a pretty big problem to overcome. But at the moment, I'm not worried about that at all, because if there's no Verratti, it's probably going to be Locatelli. If it's not going to be Locatelli, it's going to be Pellegrini. There are so many good options in midfield for Italy that isn't a worry. I think there are things that you can pick at with it. I personally really like the collection of forwards they have. I think Federico Chiesa has been so good at Juventus this season. Lorenzo Insigne is destined for his big moment that he's been waiting for a whole career for. I think that Immobile, whilst he's never scored as regularly for the national team as he has at Lazio, I think he's showing signs that he's finding that a bit more comfortable than he used to. I think Mancini is getting more from him. If you want me to pick those holes with it, actually, it's the bit that most people are going to point out. People don't pay attention to go, oh, well, they've still got Chiellini and Bonucci at the back. I'm not sure Chiellini and Bonucci are still as reliable a tandem as people think they are. I think that tandem is potentially a bit iffy. I think the other issue is just, yes, there is a lack of an absolute, totally feel confident number nine in the team. So yes, if Immobile doesn't do it, do you trust Belotti? Not really. But even then, I like that you have Raspadori, who joined the squad at the last moment, who's been really interesting for Sassuolo. I love that you could go with a false nine, use Berardi, who's been brilliant. I actually really like this Italy team, and I'm really excited for it. So probably it'll be awful.
Lars?
Is it? I feel like this Italy team is really very much the opposite of what we usually associate with Italy in terms of strengths and weaknesses. Because you're right, that defence, I always get a bit worried when you have slow centre-halves and very attack-minded fullbacks. That seems like a worrying combination to me, especially Spinazzola is going to go forward quite a lot, and that leaves them with having to do quite a lot of running on the counter, I wonder, those two, and that's not what you want. And on the other hand, you always associate Italy, like, really difficult to score against, and they have at least one number nine that scares the absolute daylights out of you, which they don't have either, but they should be a fun team to watch, right?
I think they're going to be heaps of fun to watch. I actually think as well, I said this to someone the other day, I think that Mancini maybe doesn't get his dues as a manager. He did win in situations where people looked at it and went, oh, well, that's a favourable situation. So you won at Inter after Juventus had been dumped out of the top flight because of Calciopoli. You won at Man City when they just had all of this money lumped into him. But some other people around him didn't win at Man City, by the way. And I think he was, the fact that he was the one who ended the sort of period in the wilderness for them, I think it matters. I think he's a really undervalued manager who seems so comfortable in himself at the moment. And again, just the consistency of results is something that you don't normally see from Italy. And I suppose if you wanted to be negative about it, what you would say is, well, Italy normally do best when everyone thinks they're going to come in and do terribly. So if that's the biggest criticism I can find, then fine, maybe things will turn out differently. But they are playing really well.
Now, look, Wales, this is a difficult group, isn't it? And we'll talk about Turkey and Switzerland in a second. Wales, John, you know, you just think they had such an amazing tournament last time. And you know, against most of the odds, you know, there was no way they were going to beat Belgium. There was no way Hal Robson-Kanu was going to Cruyff turn and the whole stadium go the other way. And yet they did that. And you just wonder, to recreate that would be incredibly impressive.
It would. And I was lucky to be a long part of that journey, actually, in 2016. Fantastic. I remember I got a call, quite a few calls, actually, at first weekend of the tournament. Oh, I hope you're not in Marseille. Don't worry, I'm in Bordeaux with the Welsh, and they were having a great time and, you know, no trouble at all. And they had such a great ride through the tournament, and Chris Coleman was so statesmanlike. It's going to be a little bit different this time. Obviously, you've got the issue of Robert Page having to step in. I'm not sure Robert Page is quite the statesman that Chris Coleman is, but he's done a pretty good job with them. And, of course, you've got the issue of the squad being a sort of mix of perhaps a little bit over the top. We're talking about Gareth Bale there now. We mentioned on the pod last time I was on, actually, that I flagged up that I thought he might retire after this tournament. I still think that, by the way. And you've got this issue of how they're going to play up front with Kiefer Moore, who's does seem to make the team better, but can you play him with Gareth Bale in the team as well? And you've got Daniel James, and does Harry Wilson drop out? And you've got players like Johnny Williams, like who's this sort of pinch hitter, almost pretty much plays only for Wales, as far as I can gather. If they were to replicate anything like 2016, it would be amazing. I can't really see it. I think it's a pity that the fans are going to be out in Baku, aren't they? Which is not quite the same as gallivanting ground France. But I wish them well. I'd just be a little bit concerned about how well they're going to do.
Turkey cruised through qualification, finished second behind France. They took 4 points off France. Yeah. They're Barry's dark horses, which is not necessarily a great...
Barry said Wolves were going to win the title, didn't he?
Well, at least they're in the tournament. I mean, that's...
The Wolves, Christian Benteke. Now, he has done some good predictions before. Why are they good? What's good about Turkey?
They've got that sort of core of Lille players, don't they? Lille, who just won Ligue 1. They've got Yilmaz, who's just been absolutely banging in the goals. They've got Yazici, they've got Celik. All of those sort of three have been playing so well. I actually think that, arguably, looking at this group and Yilmaz, it's ridiculous because he's like 35, but they might be the only team in the group where you look at and think, well, there is the classic number nine who's just going to win you some games.
Yeah, they got a very solid defence as well with Sun Yunshu and Demiral in central defence, probably Zeki Celik from Lille right back. It's pretty robust. Uka Yukuslu, who you've seen at West Bromwich in the second half of the season, very solid defensive midfielder. There's a lot of good stuff here. The thing I find with, like, it's a really good team on paper. Senyo Gunas is back in charge. He was the coach when they went to the semi-finals in 2002, I guess. Very respected coach there. But then they do weird stuff, like draw 3-3 with Latvia in the qualifiers, like having thumped both Holland and Norway, by the way, the highly thought of Norwegian national team, who's not very good. I find them hard to trust, if that's the right way to say it. You know, following up, it feels like very on brand for this Turkish national team to, thump Netherlands and then beat Norway convincingly with Haaland and Erdogan and the like, and then suddenly play 3-3 with Latvia for no reason. So this is the thing I wonder a little bit about. But on paper, this is a really exciting team.
And the Swiss, Jerdan Shaqiri is still key for them. As producer Joel writes, he did score a fantastic overhead kick in Euro 2016. I mean, that was 5 years ago. But,
I was there. I saw it.
A good goal, wasn't it?
It was absolutely fantastic, yeah.
So what does that mean, 5 years on?
Five years on. Well, 5 years on, I wrote a piece actually recently for a Swiss newspaper. They wanted to know about Granit Xhaka and how he's got in England. Because for them, he is such a leader, such a keynote player for them, whereas I don't think the view of him in this country is quite the same, is it? He's had a difficult time over here. I would actually say that I don't think that we've got to know him as well as we might do, as well as the Swiss know him. But they seem to have reasonably high hopes for this Swiss team. But you mentioned Shaqiri, 5 years ago, and it was a long time ago, he was a promising young player, of whom much was expected, but he's a fringe player now, isn't he? He's a fringe player at Liverpool, admittedly a good club. But I suppose you've got this question of, that you occasionally get, are some players better for their country than they are for their club? I think the Swiss are hoping that that's the case with Shaqiri and Xhaka.
So are we going Italy, Turkey, Switzerland, Wales? Happy with that?
Yeah, that's my order.
Okay, fine. Let's do Group B, Belgium, Denmark, Finland and Russia. Go on then.
Fully Group A.
Let's go Scandi, Lars. Obviously, Belgium the favourites for this. We'll get on to Belgium, but talk to us about the Danes and the Finns.
Yeah, okay. So the Danes are probably quite good, I think. I think they're sort of my sort of dark horses slightly. They have, and again, I keep saying this, they have a really good spine, which I think helps you in a tournament. Like, I think tournaments is all about being rugged, mainly. You rarely see a sort of wildly exciting attacking team come out of nowhere and do well at international tournaments. It tend to be the teams that mess up the least. And I trust Denmark not to mess up very often. You know, the sort of the spine there with Kasper Schmeichel in goal. Simon Kjær has had maybe his best season in his career for Milan this season. It's been tremendous. Andreas Christensen has been back in the frame for Chelsea, so he'll be in good shape. Højbjerg looked a bit leggy towards the end of the season for Tottenham, but he is a very good player next to Thomas Delaney of Dortmund. Very beefy midfield there. And Christian Eriksen, again, back in the frame at Inter, should be in good shape, flitting about, playing passes. That's a really good sort of start of a team, and then you do wonder a little bit where the goals are coming from. Josef Poulsen and Martin Braithwaite are good players, but maybe not sort of notorious goal getters. So my concern would be in front of goal. But the draw has not been, you know, too terrifying on them. You'd expect Belgium to win this group, but the second place very much up for grabs. And I like Denmark.
Warren says, is Finland in Scandinavia? Do the Scandic mountains define what is and isn't?
No, I would
Scandic?
Say Nordic, but I actually. Had a minor falling out with a lady friend in Finland about this back in the day. She was absolutely furious that I wouldn't consider Finland part of Scandinavia, but they're not. They are a Nordic country, though.
Okay.
And culturally, of course, there are very deep ties there.
Yeah. Either way, Teemu Pukki playing just in front of Jari Litmanen and in their first major tournament.
At the back, you know. Petri Paasonen in defence. Annu Tiihinen coming back.
This is their first tournament. Tell us about their coach, Markku Kanerva,
who was, I mean, so the story goes, and I'm not making this up. I spoke to a sort of prestigious local journalist called Ari Virtanen in Finland, who confirmed to me one of the main reasons he got the job was that the FA was a bit skint. they had sacked their manager, and there wasn't a lot of room in the budget to appoint a new one, so they couldn't go for a big-name foreigner or even a big-name Scandinavian. So they gave it to Markku Kanerva, who was the assistant national team manager at the time. Not a huge managerial CV, but he had brought the under-21s to the under-21 Euros, I believe, or World Cup, it might have been, in 2009. So he had a record of getting at least one Finnish team to a tournament. As a player, he played for HJK Helsinki. He got like 59 caps, but he started working as a teacher on the side, because you don't become very wealthy from playing domestic football in Finland, and you certainly didn't in the 90s. So he was, you know, very much heading for a career. He was going to get into teaching, as we say on the show. But instead, he ended up working as a coach and working with the FA and, you know, progressing to the point of becoming the national team manager. And he's been very, very successful. He has fostered a sort of a positive atmosphere where everyone is seen and heard. And he's very much an inclusive sort of type of leader. And they have a team with really no egos. Everyone fights for each other. Of course, Pukki is the big star, but he's a very humble guy anyway. Listen, player for player, you have to say it's one of the weakest teams in the tournament. There's no way around that. But as Nicky said, there is always a team that is, in theory, one of the weakest in the tournament that turns out not to be that way. And why not Finland?
I know we're going to talk to Marcus in a second about this extraordinary effort the Guardian made to have a profile of all 622 players. And they also have something on each of the managers, and I haven't managed to read all 622, but this was one of my favourite things that I have read in that extraordinary Guardian profile of the manager, Markku Kanerva. Markku is a very common name among Finnish men. There is even a Finnish Markku Union that has an annual Markku of the Year award, which he won in 2009 after that under-21 championship.
So he has been the Markku of the Year before, and he no doubt will be again.
Do we think that the Belgian golden generation, the gold is just sort of peeling off now? You know, to, you know, a bit like the, you know, when the English golden generation, they're all still playing, but they're all quite old, you know. Alderweireld, Vertonghen.
It's true what you're saying, because the defence is old. The defence is really old. But I don't know. Maybe I have got too much my Serie A Benzes on. But I feel like Lukaku is going to come into this tournament feeling absolutely bullish, because he's just won Serie A and been the key player of winning Serie A, and has brand new murals of him painted up around San Siro. And I think that matters. I think you carry that confidence with you into a tournament. And I don't know. I think Belgium, they're literally number one in the world ranking. So it feels like anything short of winning the whole thing becomes a disappointment. But I think they're going to go. I think they're going to go in this tournament. I think they could be at least the semi-final team.
Russia, finally. Can somebody give me a pithy 60 seconds on Russia? Lars.
I find Russia hard to judge because a lot of the team's players play domestically, which doesn't mean that they're bad. I should stress that. There can be a ton of reasons why they haven't moved abroad, but it makes it harder for us to assess them because we don't see them much. There are some players who were good in the World Cup there. I mean, we know the big man up front, Juba, is a handful and an uncomfortable player to play against. And you have, you know, Golovin, who is good at his best and has had some good moments for Monaco playing off him. Alexei Miranchuk, who's mostly come off the bench for Atalanta, but has looked good at times. Clever, sort of technical attacking player. Those two playing off Juba, yeah, but potentially good.
I'm not sure at all how much Miranchuk plays, to be honest with you. I don't know. It's exactly as Lars says. It's hard to sort of judge teams, not because they're bad, but because you can't follow every league in Europe. And I think one of the things that bothered me a lot in the Guardian preview of Russia, because we have this experts network, so we have people who are watching the domestic leagues as well much more. When it was portrayed that Igor Akinfeev not being there was like a really big deal, and that this was going to be really sort of costing their strength, I think I'm not certain that Igor Akinfeev being there would be something that I would think should be a major factor for a team's chances of succeeding or not, because we're not talking about Gordon Banks in his prime, are we?
Well, the good news is, though, that Yuri Zhirkov is back. He's always around, isn't he?
37 now.
37-year-old. Is he on the wing? 37-year-old winger. That is fair play. You've got to be playing holding midfield by 37, haven't you? Put them in a 1-2-3-4, please. Nikki.
All right. Belgium first and Denmark second. And sure, Finland third and Russia fourth.
Yes. Okay. I like it.
Right, that'll do for part two. We'll do the other two groups in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, the fiver. You can get it on your email for the whole of Euro 2020. A free and funny daily email sent to your inbox at midday around then, every weekday through the tournament. You can subscribe now at gu.com/the-fiver. Let's bring in football editor Marcus Christensen, who has single-handedly ranked all of the 622 players for Euro 2020. How are you, Marcus?
Yes, I'm good. I'm still recovering from this little project. I think it just launched on Friday. But it's it's nice to see it up there.
Yeah, you've profiled every player, and that is quite a feat. How have we managed to do that?
So it's part of this expert network, which is a great thing. So it's one publication per country. So it's France Football, El País, Die Zeit from Germany, and from every country. And the Guardian has laid claim to Scotland, Wales and England then. So they have sent tactical previews, one main player profile, and then these small profiles of every single player at the Euro. So without them, obviously, it would have been impossible. And the good thing is that with the local knowledge comes the kind of the information you want, the anecdotes and so on. So it's completely different from sitting here trying to look up on Google or Wikipedia what these players are all about.
Yeah. And that's, you know, the more fun stuff, like Nikki was saying, is, you know, the union of the Marku Union in Finland. And, you know, those kind of things. Yeah. Give us a couple of other sort of interesting things that you have discovered that you didn't know.
So some of my favourites, I think I mentioned on the chat yesterday, there's a Switzerland defender, Loris Benito, who plays for Bordeaux, which not everyone may be familiar with. But in March 2013, apparently, he was playing a left-back for Zurich and attempted to slide tackle a Pine Marten who had invaded the pitch. And then he said, in hindsight, it was probably a little bit foolish. You don't know what kind of diseases they might be carrying. I mean, that is absolutely gold. I mean, so
never tackle a Pine Marten. Everyone knows
exactly
that.
That's today's lesson, maybe. And then there's Jonas Hoffmann of Germany and Borussia mentioned Gladbach, and he was asked whether he wanted a few more hours in each day, and he said yes, a couple more wouldn't be bad at all. So he runs a property firm, he owns three subway branches, and likes to play golf, darts, and to read. I do like an adventure, he said. I love astronomy and have a big telescope at home. It would be a dream to see the world from as far as possible. I mean, that's you look okay, at that yeah. And you think, Jonas Hoffmann, you're a great guy. I want you to do well.
I didn't think he'd be opening a franchise of Subway on the moon. That's an impressive thing to do.
Exactly.
Has doing all this sort of changed how you think the tournament might go, or not really?
I don't think so, but it has got me very excited about the Euros. And obviously, I was knackered. It took pretty much a month, day and night, to do this. And there was a few people at the Guardian, David Hills and Steve Law and so on, who helped enormously. So towards the end, when there were four players in the Turkey squad that we didn't have, because everyone pre-filed 30, because we thought we'd be safe there. And then Turkey announced the squad, and there were four players from nowhere, absolutely nowhere. And I nearly cried a little bit then. But I have recovered from that. They sent the new ones, then we got them ready and so on. It has got me, there's so many great stories, there's so many great players and so on. So it's actually got me really excited about the Euros.
Yeah, and worth remembering, you know, all these players have backstories and family, and all have journeys to get there. And this is like a huge deal for them. Remind people where they can find it.
So it's on the football front page of The Guardian. It's the interactive. It's called Everything You Need to Know About All 622 Players. So just search that and The Guardian.
How is it interactive? Yeah. Can you sort of... You can't talk to all the players.
No, that is true. It's a good point, actually. It's always called an interactive because it's made by the good people in design and the interactives team. I don't actually know why, but there will be play ratings for every performance in the tournament that will be fed into that. That's still not interactive, but quite a nice one that keeps it going throughout the tournament. And that obviously starts on Friday night.
Right. Now we've got you. Can we do Group E? Then we'll let you go, Marcus. But the mighty Swedes are in there with Poland, Slovakia and Spain. No Zlatan, which would have been a great story for him to be there. But I don't know if that is a good or a bad thing that he's not made it.
Well, it's funny. When I found out that he was injured and couldn't make it, I was pretty disappointed, actually. I thought it looked great. It was great to have him back. I think, whispered, he may have matured a little bit and he was ready to be more of a team player, and he was welcome back on different terms than in 2016 when he was running the whole team. I mean, no one dared say anything, the coach didn't dare to say anything, and it didn't work because Sweden, we need to play as a team and so on. So it's really exciting to have him back. However, they did really well in qualifying without him, and they have, I think, a better team than in 2018 when we obviously reached the quarterfinals only to fall to those
the brave Lions.
Exactly. Yeah. They're really good. It's they've got Kulusevski from Juventus, Alexander Isak from Sociedad, and we have something we haven't had for a long time, which is an attacking central midfielder in Christopher Olsson, who could change the dynamics a little bit. A backline, it's a bit risky, and obviously when we're playing Lewandowski and Spain and so on, we could struggle. My fear is kind of in Sweden, we think, okay, Spain we'll probably lose to, but we'll beat Poland and Slovakia, and I'm not sure about that.
Lars, talk to me about Poland.
They're in a slightly sort of chaotic is a word that comes to mind, because they changed coach fairly recently, brought in Paulo Sousa various clubs. I guess he's been around the block a bit, Paulo Sousa has. And I guess it is simplistic, but really the whole thing is you have to try to provide a reliable supply of chances to Robert Lewandowski, and that has always been the issue for Poland. And I find it very hard to be very, very confident in their ability to do so in this tournament either.
I think there's it's not just that as well. I think Zieliński behind Lewandowski is a really special player. I think he's been brilliant for Napi this season, really brilliant. But Lewandowski needs some more support than one player. And could it have been Krzysztof Piątek? Maybe, but he's out. Could it have been Arkadiusz Milik? Maybe, but now he's out as well. So it really is going to be for the goals, just Lewandowski.
Yeah, and with Zieliński as well, there's been an issue with there. Basically, he hasn't always been great for the national team either. And they're a little bit, there's not a lot of pace in this team. They're a bit sort of heavy and slow, which means you often end up playing quite deep, which is not great for Lewandowski because he ends up being quite far away from the goal. And I don't know, I'm not at all excited about this Poland team. I do apologize to our dear Poland listeners, but I'd be very surprised if they had a good tournament.
What about the Slovaks, Nicky? I mean, Mark Hamsik obviously was in Serie A for years and years and years. They've got Milan Skriniar as well. I mean, your knowledge is better than mine.
Well, funnily enough, I wanted to ask Marcus about Hamsik, as Hamsik is one of those players who it almost doesn't feel plausible that he's still only 33. Like, it feels like he should be older than that. And he went off to play in China, and it felt certainly from the Italian perspective that it was like, all right, well, you've had a lovely career, off you go to retirement, basically. And now he came back just before the Euros to Sweden, actually, and played at Göteborg. And I know when he arrived, there was great fanfare around that in Sweden. I don't know how it really went for him once he got there, Marcus.
Yeah, I mean, it's the biggest signing for the Swedish top flight Allsvenskan for ever, possibly. He hasn't played that much for Gothenburg, and they've drawn pretty much all their games. So you can't say he's made a massive impact. But what he said when he arrived, he said he wanted to get some minutes to get in shape for the Euro. So I think he used them as much as they benefited from him coming there. But I think it is Slovakia's over-reliance on Hamsik is a real worry, because he missed the World Cup qualifiers and they struggled without him.
John, the Spanish, they're all isolating, which is it's interesting that COVID may have some huge impact on this tournament. You know, it may at any point during the tournament, you know, it could happen, and bubbles, you know, are important. It's interesting, given I think Steve Clarke's let players go home and see their family. I'm not sure if Gareth Southgate's done the same thing. But at the moment, that seems like a tricky way to start a tournament. But I don't know what state the Spanish are in.
Yeah. I mean, you look through the squad and you think that they've finally broken the chain with the glory days of 2008, 2010, 2012. And obviously, omitting Sergio Ramos is the signifier of that, isn't it? And funnily enough, the player who is the cause of this panic, Sergio Busquets, would have been another survivor of that. And we wait to see whether he will play any part. I don't think he will be doing at this point. So you've got, I mean, you look at this team and you think it's like it's a group of, that you haven't seen that often. Jordi Alba is the captain. Of course, he is a 2012 survivor. But, I mean, the call-up of Laporte, finally, suggests, again, as I mentioned earlier, that you get these late call-ups where a manager's, well, not exactly panicking, but they take a wildcard option. Not that Laporte is any type of wildcard. And then, I mean, up front, you've got a great deal of talent. But Gerard Moreno, who's so good for Villarreal when they won the Europa League, is, we have him down as the main goal scorer. I don't predict great things for Spain. I think Luis Enrique's got a very difficult job there, and that's obviously been made much harder by what's gone on in the prelims.
They've only taken 24 players. They've taken 24 when you're allowed to take 26. And I think this whole situation with Busquets only sort of amplifies the oddness of that decision, because we are still in a pandemic. Players might get sick. They might restrict your options. So why wouldn't you use the maximum number you're allowed to use? And when you do that and leave out Ramos, and I think there's a perfectly valid reason that you've just highlighted why you might want to make a point of leaving out Ramos, but it it does feel odd that there aren't two more players in all of Spanish football that you think actually they'd be useful to have along in case someone gets sick. It's an odd decision to me.
Because of what's happened to Busquets, they've now got, I think, five players training in a parallel bubble. Good for news for you, Marcus. to add in, Pablo Fornals and Rodrigo of Leeds are in that, along with Carlos Soler, Bryce Mendes and Raul Albiol. Mendes, you said, Lars, was on holiday when he got the call.
Yeah, he was in Mykonos, apparently, okay. when he got the call, which is hopefully he's been keeping fit.
But they're in a parallel bubble. Who knows what will happen? But it is interesting that they didn't pick as many players as they could. And honestly, they didn't pick Ramos and just left an empty space. That's a sad time for anyone, isn't it?
Iago Aspas as well, another tremendous season with Celta, and it just they'd rather take an empty hole than him, which I feel like is an unnecessary diss.
It seems to me that Enrique's done the classic thing of, we probably aren't going to win this, so let's select a group of young players and see what we can do with it, which sort of, I suppose it's a manana situation. It puts off the judgment until next time around, I suppose.
Marcus, since you like lists, before you go, can you put Group E in an order 1 to 4, because we're going to decide who wins the whole tournament by the end of this pod.
Okay, I'll go with what the rest of the Swedes think then. I'll put Spain, Sweden, Poland, Slovakia.
Brilliant. Thanks for coming on. Good luck adding those other people to the list. Marcus Christensen.
Thanks
there,
a lot.
Football editor. Let's rattle through Group C, everybody. Austria, Netherlands, North Macedonia and Ukraine. Frank de Boer said, we are between 4th and 8th strongest team. We're good enough to reach the semi-final. Is that fair, Lars?
I think so. You were mentioning the sort of who's favourite with the bookies and stuff, and I think Holland are just behind. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yeah, they're 8th ranked if we're going by the winner odds with certainly the bookmaker I'm looking at. But they are some way behind the quartet of Spain, Germany, Portugal, and Italy, who are sort of on the same price. Listen, I again, we don't, this pod has gone on, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but I'm kind of fascinated by Holland because there is the ingredients, is, I think, for a good team here. There are some really good players. I think even with Virgil van Dijk out, Stefan de Vrij and Matthias de Ligt are really good defenders. I think in midfield, Frenkie de Jong, Wijnaldum, and probably Martin de Roon, I mean, that's a good midfield three. Memphis Depay can score goals. What they've been, but I'm not sure what they're doing tactically. I mean, he's been playing 5-3-2 in the last two friendlies, which has been fairly unpopular in Holland, as I understand it. Frank de Boer insists that it's a formation they might need, I think was his words, which is interesting. They maybe don't have the sort of traditional sort of terrifying flying wingers that we associate with Dutch football, so maybe a wing-back system makes sense. A two up front allows them to play sort of the giant man, Wout Weghorst, who scored a lot of goals for Wolfsburg, next to Depay to give them a target man next to him. But it's a very un-Dutch-like way of approaching things, and it's bound to be quite unpopular unless it's wildly successful. I'm not expecting a ton of things from the Dutch, and Frank de Boer, who's had a pretty iffy career outside of Holland as a club coach, he has a lot to prove, basically.
Nicky, can you round up the rest of the group? I'm conscious that the Euros will have finished by the time we finish this podcast.
By the time we finish. I think it was Lars mentioned about Weghorst to Netherlands. Austria have an even bigger striker, Sasa Kalajdzic.
Yes.
He's 6'7", so I'm looking forward to that battle of the giants, hopefully.
Actually 2 meters, Sasa Kalajdzic did, which I have nothing but respect for.
Austria, I think, are probably about where you expect Austria to be. They still have David Alaba. They've still got some other elements around him that are interesting. I think it's going to be a bit predictable, though, around Kalajdzic and getting the ball up to the big man. North Macedonia are the other team in the group. They are obviously the biggest wild card of the whole tournament. They qualified through Nations League D. They had to beat Armenia, Gibraltar, Liechtenstein to win their group, and then Kosovo and Georgia in the playoffs. So they haven't had the toughest route to get here, but they did beat Germany away in World Cup qualifying. They had a goal from Goran Pandev, the eternal Goran Pandev, as we would probably describe him in Italy. Look, beyond Goran Pandev, I'm not certain there's a heap of talent here. I know a lot of people are sort of talking about Elmas, but even he was basically a backup at Napoli all season. He came off the bench a lot. I can't tell you much about the detail of the squad because a lot of them play in leagues that I don't follow regularly, but I can tell you I'm excited to see this team because this is the whole joy
about,
of the expanded
right?
tournament.
Absolutely.
It's the whole joy of the expanded tournament is having teams like that come in.
Ukraine, of course, finally, Shevchenko, their coach, Zinchenko playing centre mid.
And Malinovsky, who really has been brilliant in the second half of the season in Italy, one of the most fun players to watch in the second half of the season in Italy, not just because he has what I believe the Alan Partridge term would be a foot like a traction engine.
Yes.
He absolutely can. It's such a weird thing to say, but there are a few players who I see as often just hit the ball really flipping hard as he does. But he's also shown some real subtlety to his game. Subtlety to his game in the second half of the season as well. So I think he's a really exciting player to look out for.
Okay, Lars, do Group C for me then. Rank them 1-4.
Listen, it's probably the Dutch and Ukraine. I'd have them just about better than Austria and then North Macedonia. Okay. But a very close one for me.
Okay. I have a sneaky feeling about this Ukraine team. I don't know why. Just mythology of Shevchenko. But I think they're going to be good.
It's one of those, like you mentioned it, we're looking forward to watching these teams that have a lot of players we're not that familiar with. And again, just to be honest, like I don't watch Dynamo Kiev and Shakhtar Donetsk that regularly. So there are a lot of guys here that I'm not like that familiar with. Malinovsky is great. Should be interesting to watch.
Okay, I've put together who I think is going through with the best third places as well. And we have the quarterfinals. So I want you to pick each quarterfinal and we'll go through in 2 minutes the entire tournament.
Doesn't it go to the last 16 or have you already done?
No, last 16. Sorry, I mean, here we go, last 16. So Italy, Ukraine, Nikki.
Well, you've come to me and I have to say Italy, don't I?
Yep, okay. Turkey, Denmark, John.
Turkey.
Belgium, Poland, Lars.
Belgium.
Holland, Germany, Nikki.
Gosh, that would be a game, wouldn't it? Let's be controversial and say Holland.
Okay, France, Switzerland, John.
France.
Croatia, Sweden, Lars.
Oh, God. Sorry, Croatia, probably.
Spain, Scotland, Nikki.
It's Spain, I'm sorry.
And England, Portugal, John.
Portugal on penalties.
Oh, God.
Oh, no. Okay, here we go. Quarterfinals. France, Croatia, Lars.
France.
Belgium, Italy, Nikki.
Oh, I hate this because I think Belgium would win. I do think Belgium would win that game.
Okay. Holland, Turkey, John.
Turkey.
Oh, Spain, Portugal, Lars.
Portugal.
Okay. Semi-finals. Belgium, France, Nikki.
Oh, I'm going to say Belgium. Sod it. Yeah. Keep it going.
Wow.
Well, they've knocked out Italy now. They've got to be the favourites.
Portugal, Turkey, John.
Portugal on penalties.
Okay. Lars, who wins the Euros, Belgium or Portugal?
Oh, Christ. Portugal would win that final, I think. On penalties, John.
There we go. Portugal retain the Euros. I'm not sure how we got there. But listen, that'll do. Thanks, Lars.
Anytime, Max.
Thank you, Nikki.
Thanks.
Thanks, John.
Cheers. It's been an education.
Back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.